He saw these sites, and he was just an ordinary being, an ordinary man from a prominent family, and he just decided that this was, he wasn't satisfied with what he was seeing, and he became a seeker. And so he left behind his wife, his kids, all of his riches. We don't recommend doing that, okay? But he chose to do it. And he went off to find some kind of spiritual peace, some answers. And he tried a number of different techniques. There were all sorts of different teachers in that time. But he didn't really find from them anything that really worked for him and exactly what he wanted. So finally, he really stopped everything. Like I said, he tried all of the extremes. And these are some of the things that you see in that historical pictures of the Buddha where he, you know, this very skinny, subsisted on one grain of rice a day. So he'd had the wealth. Then he did the other extreme asceticism, and none of that really worked. And so finally he went and he sat under the Bodhi tree in what is now Bodh Gaya. This is a town in northern India, and it's the poorest section of India, and he sat underneath that Bodhi tree, and a Bodhi tree is kind of like a ficus tree to us, okay? And he looked at his mind. He observed his mind, and he looked at what he felt were the sources of his problems. And he found them all to be in his mind. Everything was in his mind. And by eliminating them, that he could achieve happiness in this lifetime as a human being. But he wasn't a god. Okay? He was not a god. He was just a man. So after he did this and became enlightened, because he wasn't a god, he couldn't just wave a magic wand and enlighten you and enlighten you, he did the next best thing, and that was to teach. Okay? Not a god. So Shakyamuni Buddha, Shakya means clan, Muni means sage, and Buddha means enlightened one. And at that point, when he began to teach, is when he became Shakyamuni Buddha, they renamed. Okay? What is enlightenment? The removing obscurations, which are the negative states of mind, we talked about that, and fully developing all virtuous, which are positive states of mind. Okay? We talked about a little bit of that. Positive and negative states of mind. Let's go there for a minute. Okay. Negative states of mind. What are some?
Anger.
What?
Hate.
Fear.
Jealousy.
If I could spell, it would be better. More?
Impatience.
Confusion. Ignorance and confusion, both very good.
Attachment.
It's attachment. That's a loaded word. We're going to talk about that one. Ignorance. Envy. I heard something else. Confusion. I'm going to put that in there. Okay, there's a ton of these, and you can kind of keep going with them. Negative, right? These are negative states of mind. What are some of the positive states of mind?
Joy.
Happy.
Confidence.
Compassion. Patience.
Conversion.
Say that again.
Conversion. The opposite of jealousy. So being happy for someone else's joy.
Say the word again.
Conversion.
Oh, I don't know that word. I'm going to look that up. Conversion. Okay.
Love.
I was going to say, we're missing a big one. Love. Okay, so just in common sense, if you could remove all of this from your mind, if you could remove all of that, make it go away. Only have this stuff in your mind. You'd be a happier person, wouldn't you? Pretty simple, isn't it? I mean, this is kind of that duh. Okay, it is that simple. Simple to say, hard to actually do. But it is that simple. but now it's like, how do we do it? And what is the practice? What is the methodology to get there? Right? But it would be, if you could just get all this stuff off and only be here, you would be happier. Now, we could basically say that everybody in this room just wants to be happy, couldn't we? That's a true statement. We just want to be happy, right? Could I say everybody in North Carolina wants to be happy? That's a true statement. Everybody just wants to be happy. How about everybody in the world? Everybody in the world just wants to be happy, don't they? We could say that. How about this one? All sentient beings just want to be happy. Your dogs, your cats, your animals just want to be happy, right? Let's take it even further. Sentient being. You'll hear this term a lot in Buddhism. Sentient being. With a mind. Mind possessor. Okay? Bugs. Those cockroaches just want to be happy. Okay? It's you got to start stretching a little bit. Okay? Every sentient being, every being with a mind, the simplest, purest truth is everybody's just trying to be happy. All of those bugs, they're just trying to eat because that's part of what they need to do to live. All these animals, they just want to be happy. Okay, so now it's just like stretching it. Okay, stretch that thought process a little bit. That's the simplest truth. We just want to be happy. If we could get rid of this, focus on this, develop this, lose this, we could be happier. Okay, that's the entire concept of this Buddhism right there. So Buddha is a teacher. Let's talk about the definition of a teacher. I'm going to be throwing definitions at you this entire class because we all tend to think of things a little bit differently, so let's make sure we're always talking about things the same way. The definition of a teacher, we think of teachers like our college teachers, okay? You probably are looking at me as a teacher, okay? I don't consider myself a teacher. I'm a class leader, okay? I'm not really a teacher. But I'm sitting up here, Buddha in a class, so in our Western world, we think teacher. In our college, you have your college teachers, right? We all like these teachers. We respect them. In Buddhism, we have to be a little bit careful because they have a different definition of teacher. Okay, so for them, a teacher-student relationship is much deeper than the way we think of when we talk teachers. So for somebody to take on a teacher in Buddhism, that means that teacher is responsible. So if you went to one of these monks and said, I want you to be my teacher, they'd probably ignore you the first couple, three, four, even 10, 12 times that you even asked because you've got to, it's a different relationship. And if they take you on as a teacher, then they're responsible for you. Okay? It's a much deeper relationship. And you have to, when you're looking for a teacher in Buddhism, you don't just like look it up in the phone book and you don't come to Kadampa Center and see Geshe-la or any of these other monks sitting here and say, I want that monk for a teacher. The way that works in Tibetan Buddhism and actually in most Buddhism is that you have to study that teacher and make sure that they have specific qualities before you ever even ask them to be your teacher. So it's a much deeper relationship here. So again, it's just different. So I'm telling you these things because it's these definitions so that we're always, you know, talking about the same type of things. So the definition of a teacher from the Buddhist perspective, when he actually started teaching and giving these things, was that relationship was a little bit deeper than the way that we're talking about it. Yes, sir.
The teachers who are here at this center, how many teacher-student relationships would you say exist here?
Many. And that's about as far as I'm going to take that because that's a private, personal choice. Geshe-la, when he teaches here, he won't even call himself, when he comes in and teaches on Sundays or on Wednesdays in the classes and stuff, they call them Geshe-la and Geshe-gelig Choda and Geshe Paulding Sangpo, call themselves Dharma friends. There are Dharma friends. Okay, if you are going to have a personal teaching relationship with them, that's something that you develop on a one-on-one level with them. And it is that you have to request it. Okay, any of the FPM teachers that come here, we have a lot of visiting teachers that have students all over the world. But it's a very personal relationship. And then you will deepen your studies because, again, what works for you may not work for you. So these teachers here are highly advanced. I talked about that. Geshe is a title. That means they've done 30-plus years of study. And not only is our Geshe Galik a Geshe, he's a Lorampa Geshe, which is like summa cum laude. Okay, so these two monks are very advanced. Okay, they've been 30-plus years. They were raised in the monasteries, studied in the monasteries, and they have Sarajay Monastery, and they have the different focuses that they can do at their monasteries, but they're incredibly advanced. Plus, their teacher, Ken Rinpoche, who's over in India, he had been the abbot of Sarajay Monastery, and he was appointed by the Dalai Lama. So their teachers are very advanced. And we are so fortunate to have them here. It's not even funny. And I think a lot of people don't really understand just how advanced and fortunate we are. But that's a very special relationship. We do have people that are his students. He's got students all over the world, as does Geshe Sangpo. And there are other FPMT teachers that visit here that also have students because it's, and some of the students here have teachers that live at other places. It's a very one-on-one kind of relationship. And you can have more than one teacher, but you usually have one root teacher, but then he might point out other teachers that would be beneficial for you to talk with, depending on what you're focusing on. But it's a very special relationship. Not a god. The Buddha was not a god. And that is the one of the main points that I always try to get across in this class, because we have those conceptions with the Western, you know, oh, you come in and you do prostrations to these statues and golden statues, and we're not prostrating to false gods, just like they have in some of these other religions. We are humbling ourselves before the teachings. So when you see these people doing prostrations, okay, that is an antidote to pride. Now, I am your typical American. And when prostrations, because I've been doing this, you know, 10-plus years, I'd read about it before then, but there was practices I didn't do. And it was like, I'm not prostrating. I don't bow down. That American, you know, I even had the attitude. I'm doing it right now. It is, but I thought, you know what, I'm going to try these practices. I'm going to give a good try to be honest with myself. This is about my own mind. And when I started doing the act of prostrating and learning about it, and it's humbling yourself before the teachings. It is not about humbling yourself before these men or women. Okay? It's just like the respect that you would show any, you know, if the Dalai Lama came here, or Thich Nhat Hanh, or, you know, I don't care, the Pope, you know, I'd bow to the Pope. You know, he's an advanced teacher. If Mother Teresa was here, I would be flat on that floor, you know, because I respect her and her teachings and the way she's lived her life. That's a respect. It is a sign of respect, and it is antidote to pride. So pride should actually be up there under the negative, thinking that we're better than somebody else. The Dalai Lama, look at him. You know, he is probably one of the most amazing people on this planet. He's the most humble person that you would ever see. Geshe Galik is the same way. Humble, humble. But, I mean, so pride should actually be up there. It's one of the actually six root delusions that we're going to talk about. So prostrations is humbling. We're humbling ourselves before the teachings, not bowing to gods. Okay? So, Sir Isaac Newton, okay, what the law of gravity, right? Just a guy that discovered gravity. And that, you kind of think about the Buddha like that. He discovered what was going on. He discovered these things. He discovered the law of karma. We're going to talk about that. He discovered that all of these things are up in his mind. So if you try to think of him more as that discoverer than a god, it'll gives you a little bit better, I think, understanding of how this all works. And then he's a teacher. Okay, does that make sense? A little bit? Okay, when he started teaching, they call it the wheel of Dharma, turning the wheel of Dharma. Dharma means that which protects, that which holds. There's conventional Dharma, which are the teachings and the actions. These up here on the altar here, these are the 84,000 teachings of the Buddha. Okay, that's Dharma. Those prayer books, those gold prayer books, Dharma, because they hold the teachings, right? But so any of these things that we see, this notebook, as messy as it is, this is Dharma because there's teachings in here. The PowerPoint is Dharma because there's teaching stuff in there. That's Dharma, okay? But the teachings and the actions that we do, ultimate are the realizations that we get along the way, those aha moments. That's Dharma. That's Dharma in action when you all think, oh, I get it. Even the little ones. I'm really good at little aha moments. Okay? That's the ultimate, the realizations attained along this path to liberation and enlightenment. And this major takeaway, everything that we talk about in this class, everything that is in this center, everything that is around here, all of these tools and pictures and flags and tankas and statues and everything in here is about the mind. Everything is in here for the benefit of your mind. The Buddhism is about the mind. First, last, always, it is about the mind, working with your mind. So the first turning of the wheel, the first big teaching that he did after he became enlightened was the Four Noble Truths. So the first noble truth, we talked about this before, the truth of suffering. Second, the truth of the cause of suffering. Third, the truth of the cessation of suffering. And four, the truth of the path to the cessation of suffering. And I've talked about this. Buddhism, everybody thinks Buddhism is depressing, and it's not. It is not. I know that it's all suffering up there. Just turn it around. The truth of happiness, the truth of the cause of happiness, the truth of how to be happier, how to be happier, what do I have to do to get there? Okay? So what does this mean? So the truth of suffering is you've got to admit that you're sick, right? You're sick. The truth of the cause. Okay, so you go to the doctor, okay, you go to the doctor, and they start to give you the cause of why you're sick, right? The cessation. Well, what is it? I'm going to give you a prescription for a medicine, right? And then the last one is, well, you have to take it. You have to take the medicine, okay? I can tell you how many times my husband has gone to the doctor, gotten his medicine, taken it for the first 2 days, and then he's done. I bet some of you have done that same thing. You don't actually take it. You say you're going to take it, but you don't. Okay? I know I'm overweight. I know I should be going to the gym. I know there's all these things I should be doing. I don't do it. So we know what will make us healthier, eat better, right? What did I eat for dinner tonight? It certainly wasn't salad. Okay? So we know this stuff, right? We know what we should be doing, but do we do it? No. It's the same thing like this. We know we should be doing it, but we don't actually do it. Or we do it a little bit. I'm really good at a little bit. Okay? Which is why it's just lower level class. Okay? But it's all right here. But we just actually have to do it. So then we start talking about, well, what are the things that we can do? What are some of those things that we can do? So we're going to break some of that down a little bit. But going back to, so Buddhism started in India, spread Sri Lanka, Asia, Southeast Asia, China, Japan, Tibet. Many different Buddhist traditions came out of this, but it all pretty much was more due to cultural, socioeconomic, geography, just some of the variations that just happened. Just with how Buddhism spreads around. You can see it in the artwork and the iconography. Thailand has the Buddhas with more of that pointy hat. Japan is more of the calmer Zen type of colors. Okay, you go China, it has many different kinds. So you've got there, they've got, you know, the laughing Buddhas and all the different ones. So you just have, and even over here in the West, I mean, now Buddhism is decoration. I mean, it's become Buddha light, you know, or there's all kinds of different ways to look at this. But it's just very interesting to see how it takes on these different aspects just because of culture and then where you're going to be coming from and where we're learning. So we're learning, we're sitting in a Tibetan Buddhist center, okay? So Tibet is colorful, okay? They even say gaudy. We have bling. Tibetan Buddhism has bling. We like the bling. So the very bright colors. Well, Tibet is a high plain. You know, so their culture has bright colors inside because it's, you know, snowy and cold and white and very gray on some of these times, so they bring a lot of color. It's their culture. So the different strains of Buddhism, different kinds, they're all very similar. They all have the basic core of Buddhism, but the Hinayana and Theravada is more about the individual release from suffering. You'll hear this term, nirvana. And the Mahayana, universal, that not only includes the nirvana, but also enlightenment. So, and it's more the greater vehicle. They call it greater and lesser, but that kind of makes you feel like one's better than the other, and they shouldn't be. They're very equal. The Mahayana is more about, well, I want to become enlightened so I can help everybody. Okay, whereas the Hinayana and Theravada really focuses more on here because they figured you've got to do this first before you do that, whereas Mahayana will say, well, this can all be worked on together. So it's no one is not better than the other. They're just different. Now, you were asking. Yes, sir.
I was going to ask a question. In doing research, you know, it would say that Tibetan Buddhism was part of Vajrayana tradition, and then looking around, we are affiliated with FPMT,
mm-hmm.
and that was like a source of confusion for me. And if we're in the Vajrayana tradition, how are we also Mahayana? And isn't it true that some traditions consider the Hinayana term to be derogatory?
Yes. But that is what it would be called a wrong view. Okay? So one of the biggest things that you really try to learn is that we don't put other groups down. Okay? It's not having that pride in your own and lesser. You just don't go there. We are Mahayana. Okay, so the FPMT Mahayana, there's a blending of some, and again, some of the stuff we're not going to go too deep on because there is a lot of different lists and stuff and different ways to look at stuff. And there's actually even another with the tantric path. So there's different paths for all of these things. And the Vajrayana and Hinayana and Mahayana are all so similar that it's better to just go with finding more in common than worrying about what is different, and then finding which path seems to work with you best, because they're so closely related that it's really, I think, a bit of a toss-up. So it's finding the teachers that you like, the teachings that you like, and that seem to chime with you a little bit. That make a little sense? I'm being a little careful with how I answer that question because it's a good question, but it's a deep question. But and I've heard some very high teachers talk about never ever saying negative things about anybody else's practice.
Yeah, I was just looking at a flow chart today of the different traditions, and Tibetan broke off of the Vajrayana branch, and then I was thinking about, well, you know, Tadap was affiliated with FPMT.
It's the Mahayana.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I'm going to ask later.
Yeah. Ask later. And another good one is, okay, so you say you're looking at flowcharts and stuff. So pay attention to with the source of the flowchart. Okay. So I always will say, well, what's that source? Because some of it depends. It's also interesting. You can pull up 10 different Buddhist websites, okay, and then just depending on what their source is will be how it's portrayed. And I always find that interesting. It's just like anything else. But one of the teachings that the Buddha, that I hold so hard, is that whatever the teaching, whatever the fact, whatever the information that you are given, you need to look at this very clearly, very carefully, just as a gold assayer would like look at that piece of gold and study it. Is it true? Does it work for you? And if it works for you, then you can accept it. If it doesn't work for you, then you have to throw it away. Just because the Buddha says it, just because the teacher says it, does not mean that you should accept it blindly. You have to think about it and prove it to yourself. So there's no blind faith in Buddhism. Just because you hear a teacher, just because you hear Geshe-la say it, just because you hear me say it, just because you read it in a book someplace, you need to inspect that very carefully and closely and decide for yourself if that's true or not. Now, the other thing is, so there is no blind faith, but there is other types of faith. Because I've been working with Geshe-la for years, because he's been teaching me things that seem to work for me, okay, I will take what Geshe-la says and work with it. Not blindly, but because I have a trust in him and a respect for him that his teachings have been working for me. I don't take anything blindly, but I'm going to listen to what he says and I'm going to try to put it into practice and discover for myself, because I have a consistent relationship already that what he's been saying is working for me. So I'm going to keep going there until it doesn't. Does that make sense? But yeah, FPMT is definitely Mahayana. And Kadampa Center is part of the FTMT, and we are definitely Mahayana. Now, there are four schools. All are found in the West. So the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism, Nyingma, Kagyu, Sakya, and Gelug. The Dalai Lama is Gelug. Now, he has been the spiritual leader of all of Tibetan Buddhism. He was the political leader of Tibet, but he stepped out of that. Okay, he abdicated his position as the political leader. He is still the spiritual leader of all of them. Okay? So Gelug, Kagyu is, I'm trying to remember who the Karmapa. Whom I rode in an elevator with one time. It was hilarious. I was at a teaching, and it's like I got in the elevator, and he came in right after me, and I froze. It was like, it was one of these, I just kept doing this, and he just looked over, and he went, oh my God. I just completely froze. It was so awesome. But the Karmapa is Kagyu. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, I don't know who the main leaders of the others, but the Dalai Lama is. Now, you have a question about these. So, Tibetan Buddhism, they're all very, very similar. I don't know what the difference is, like, to be able to just point and be so specific, but I know that it is, like, more of a scholarly line, especially the Gelug is definitely they're all scholarly because they follow the Lamrim, but it's like they just have different focuses on which one. I want to say it's kind of like Methodists and, you know, all of these different Christian lines where it's just the same thing, just a little bit different focus. But I couldn't define that. Could you guys break that down any better? It's just different focuses, right?
Right. And Nyingma and Sakya are not in practice. I mean, they're not. Gelug and Kagyu are practiced extensively, but I don't think the other two schools are practiced in North America.
I know that they could find them because that was part of the thing, but I'm not sure exactly where, and it's a little bit smaller.
Right, it's the lineage of teachers more than anything. I mean, there's no difference in the practice.
Because the Tibetan, yeah, there's no difference. Is it just literally because of the teachers?
Right, right. It's like the Karmapa is equivalent to Dalai Lama.
Right.
It's just a different,
right, a different lineage
of teachers.
Okay.
And schools.
That
and
makes it a little bit
monasteries,
more
sense. Monasteries. So, until.
Yeah. So that makes a little bit more sense. Yep.
So, I studied martial arts, and it's the same thing. You get different schools, mm-hmm. They all practice karate or whatever.
But depending on the original teacher, you've got different schools, even though they all study the same thing. So why do we hear so much about the Dalai Lama, but we don't hear about the other teachers?
So the Dalai Lama, number one, when he had to leave China, or had to leave Tibet, because of the Chinese, there was a lot of press. Okay, so we tend to know about the Dalai Lama because it was a big thing at that time. And there had been all of the different movies, okay? If you remember back in the day in the 50s and 60s, all the hippies had been going over to, you know, I mean, they even make movies out of it now. So I think that there was a lot of press. And this is one of the things you can actually look at from an interesting philosophy discussion. Because all of the horrible things that forced him out of Tibet and into this life of exile are the very things that have brought Buddhism to the West. So that's where the taking suffering as a path, all of the horrible things that have happened, have actually helped a lot of the Westerners learn about it. Now, the Dalai Lama, the person that he is, also, I think, is very appealing to the Western, and he comes here and he teaches here a lot. So I think a lot of it is his personality, the very fact that he's the Dalai Lama, which is the main spiritual leader of all of them. Even though the Karmapa is the main teacher for Kagyu, he defers to the Dalai Lama. So the Dalai Lama is the spiritual leader of all of Tibet Buddhism. And the Dalai Lama has also made a concerted effort to learn English, to study, and to visit over here. And he's very fascinated by all of our science and all of our things. And Europe, it's not only the United States. I mean, he really has reached out to the entire world. But I think it's part of it is his appeal, his personality. How many people here have been able to see him in person? We're hoping that he comes to Raleigh next year. And if he does, that would be phenomenal. It's my aspirational wish. We'll just see what happens. But I think that his personality, his books are what drew me to Buddhism as a child and as a young teen. I just have read the Dalai Lama. My favorite book of all time, The Art of Happiness. It is a very basic book, very easy to read book, and it helps with just understanding some of the basic concepts. It's one of the best books ever. He's got a book out now too with Desmond Tutu called The Book of Joy. And so, he interacts and works with all of the different spiritual leaders of the world. So, yeah, he's a very amazing man. So, again, everything is about the mind, developing positive states of mind, removing negative states of mind. That is the very definition of enlightenment. And we started working on this already. What are those positive states of mind? What are the negative states of mind? Wow. Okay, now let's talk about what is the mind. Okay, we did this a little quickly last time. The mind is non-physical. It is not the brain. The mind is not the brain. The brain is the physical. The mind is non-physical. It is clear. It's like clear sky, clear lake. So if you imagine that sky, okay, just picture that Carolina blue sky, right? Your mind is like that. The clouds coming through are not a part of the sky. They're in the sky, but they're just coming through. So the clouds would be like your thoughts, okay? And you can have beautiful white fluffy clouds, or you can have black rain clouds. You get to choose, all right? But that's kind of an analogy. The mind is like a clear sky or a lake. Those thoughts are not an intrinsic part. They're just flowing through. What is the mind? It is aware. We always talk about five senses in the United States, okay? Sight, sound, smell, touch, and taste. With this, we add mental awareness. So we actually have six. Six senses. Sight, sound, smell, touch, taste, and mental awareness. Its function is to know. That's its job, to know. And it has no beginning and is continually changing. Okay, we touched on this last time. That is the basic premise of our rebirth, and we're going to get into this a little bit more soon enough. Because it is like this, we have the ability to change our minds. This is the most empowering thing about Buddhism, period, is we have the power to work with our minds. We have the power to change our minds. Yes.
And I did start reading the book a little bit.
Yeah, it's a great book.
And right there in the first chapter, it was explaining how all people are equal because we all have our minds, and you can have every other difference physically, wealth, or et cetera, but we can all equally use our minds to improve ourselves.
Yep, all of us. That's what I find so empowering about Buddhism. We all have what's called Buddha nature. We all have this ability. Every person in this room, every person on this planet has that ability to work with their mind. And that I find that incredibly empowering. You have a question?
So I wonder, is the mind just in our body? If in our body, where it is?
There's another great question. Where is that mind? So that's another thing that we're going to get to actually in about class 5, okay, when we start talking about emptiness. Because where is that mind? Okay? That is a great question, and I'm not going to answer it tonight. It is not the brain, so it's not this physical thing. And actually, the mind, in the Art of Happiness, I think it is, the Dalai Lama has a great definition, and I'll see if I can find it. Because, again, we're tending to think of the mind and thoughts and things, again, from such a Western perspective. And in that book, the Dalai Lama talks about heart and mind kind of being a little bit more what we think of with this love and compassion. You know, we tend to think of all that here, you know what? But it's all here. So it's interesting. Yes, sir.
Physical?
Does the word aware? Nope, that's what mental awareness.
Where? When we say where is the mind?
Oh, where?
Can't you only use the word where to talk about something physical? I can't ask where my laugh is.
I think that, well, that's a pretty deep question. Anybody want to take a swing at that? So where, his question is, does the word where, W-H-E, R-E, where, only apply to something that is physical? And my answer would be not necessarily. But that's just my answer. When you start getting deep philosophical, we all might have different opinions. So, Chris can get deeply. okay, so that's the definition. Again, this is part of what is so empowering for me, is that it is, we have the ability to work with it. So the very fundamental concept in Buddhism that the mind is continually changing. So it's kind of like that river, right? You can step in a river at one point, step out of it, and go down a mile, step in it again. It's different. It can be flowing differently. It can be, you know, muddier down there, but it is still the same river, but it's different. So it's trying to think about these types of things. And we have the ability to work with it. And what you find in Buddhism is that firm belief in my ability to change my mind. I can't change yours. I can give you some ideas, I can help you with some concepts, I can explain some different things, but you all have to do the work. You all have to do it. I can't change your mind. I can't work with your mind. All of us have to work with our own minds. And that we can create the cause of our own happiness. We can work on this stuff. And I just find that very empowering. So how do we do that? Well, we look at our mind. We study, we practice. What do we study? Here, in Tibetan Buddhism, we study the Lam Rim, and that is the original Buddhism for dummies. So the Lam Rim was written in, what, about 1050 BC? Is that right? Is that right, Steve?
I think it's 1300.
Lama Atisha. And he literally took all of the Buddhist teachings and put them all in a nice little tidy bundle, brought them all, broke them out into a step-by-step process, and it's all the Buddhist teachings that are all compiled into this one, it's like a five-book thing out in the lobby, but it kind of breaks it all down. So it's a much structured process, teaching, graduated path, step A, step B, step C, okay, for enlightenment. And he took all of the Buddhist teachings, and that's what Tibetan Buddhism studies, okay, is the Lam Rim. And it's just an organization of all of the Buddhist teachings, step by step, simple but not easy. It's just like what we said. That seems very simple to say that, and it makes sense, but now how do we do it? Okay, so some of it is we study the Lam Rim because that gives us some of the path. So what does it mean to be Buddhist? What does it mean to be Buddhist? There is the actual definition. I'm going to give you two. The actual definition that, so again, on some of these different archives, I can give you some websites where you can kind of find some of the stuff that will have, I think, a good explanation of some things. So literally, one who has taken refuge in the three jewels of refuge, the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha, one who accepts the philosophical worldview of the four seals, that all composite phenomena are impermanent, All contaminated phenomena are in the nature of suffering. All things and events are devoid of self-existence, and nirvana is true peace. Big, lengthy thing that says the person looks inward for their source of happiness rather than out there. Okay? We look at our minds for our happiness, not out there. That's the kind of that basic, simple term. A Buddhist is an inner looker versus out there. So when we say this, okay, so happiness, let's talk about happiness. We tend to think, oh, in our conversation, in our everyday conversation, what time is it? Wow, 10 after, okay. In our everyday conversation, we even talk like this. Oh, how's your day today? Oh, I had a great day. I'm really happy because I got my raise at the work. I'm really happy because I was able to get, my new car, my new iPhone. You know, we even say that those things make us happy. We talk about that in our language every day. And so that's kind of ingrained in us. But is that happiness? If that really was happiness, then that would be a permanent thing, right? Then everybody that had money would be happy, right? Everybody that had a new car would be happy, right? Everybody that got their news, they would be happy all the time, right? If that was happiness out there, I mean, think of some of these things that we always say make us happy. If that was real, then most of the people in Hollywood would be happy because they've got all this money and fame, right? They're not. You have a question?
The concept of mind that you're talking about in this instance, does that include memories, or is it all just current awareness?
Both. We're going to get to some of that. Yeah. But yeah, your concept of mind, so mind moments, remember when we talked about that briefly? So that's part of mind moments, that there's, that we have these moments of mind, and anything that's in the past is still a moment of mind. So you do have those memories of how things happen. So that's all part of it. Yeah, so it's not just that instant, like right this particular. Your mind is this stream. Okay. Let's go back to the Four Noble Truths. So we did the admit you're sick, you get your diagnosis, you get your treatment, you get your medicine, you actually got to take the medicine. Now I want to break suffering down so that we understand suffering a little bit better. Okay, so when we think of suffering, let's go to a different color. When we think of suffering, again, I'm going to do a new word with you so that we understand what we're talking about when we say suffering. I'm going to say dukkha. Two K's, I think. Dukkha. Okay? Dukkha. That means suffering, but a greater definition for suffering. When we think of suffering, we think of this first, there's actually three types of suffering. And when we think of suffering, the suffering of pain. I just broke my leg. Ow. I have a cold. I have cancer. I have something wrong. So we think of that pain, right? Now we tend to, in America, we tend to think that that's about all suffering, right? When we're thinking of suffering, we're thinking of that. There's another type of suffering, the suffering of change. Okay, I am so happy because I just got my brand new car and somebody crashed into it. My car is now changed. And now I'm not so happy with that car anymore. I got way too hot, so I turned the air on. So now I'm going to now I'm too cold, now I'm too hot, now I'm too cold. I ordered chocolate cake and you brought me carrot cake. The suffering of change. I'm in love with Steve. He's my boyfriend and I love him and we're happy and now he doesn't love me anymore and he's going off with Mary. I'm not happy anymore. Change. Things change all the time on us. So that is suffering. That's mental suffering. You can come up with all of your definitions for change, but things change all the time, don't they? People die. Our lives change. Our jobs change. Our homes change. Things change all the time. We think that we have this solid thing, right? We think that we've got this life that is just awesome, and then something happens. Well, something's always going to happen. But why? I don't know why we think that we've got this permanent thing that we can hold on to, right? Things change. So the suffering of change, this is a little bit more emotional suffering, okay? Suffering of change. Anytime anybody wants to chime in on any of these, feel free. Suffering of change. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, pervasive compounded suffering. Big, deep meaning here that sometimes is a little bit hard to explain. Just because we live in this world, we suffer. Just because we live, this is that kind of just, things are never quite what we expect. There's always kind of that life-death cycle. Things are never quite what we expect. It's just that pervasive feeling of dissatisfaction. Okay? This is a little kind of insidious thing. And there's, again, you're going to find a lot of different definitions for this. It's a little bit harder to grasp the understanding of this, but this is just a little bit deeper. Just because we live here, just because we live on this planet, just because we deal with some sorrow, which is another, that endless cycle of life and death. Okay, there's some suffering there. So again, these are different levels of suffering. So when we're talking suffering in the Four Noble Truths, I don't want you thinking of just that top one. I want you to just mentally say dukkha, that big suffering, all of those different things that entail suffering. We just tend to think of the owl here. But suffering, we're talking about all of these different things. And some are big, some are small. Okay, some are big, some are small. But it's trying to understand. So if we don't define this, then we can't fix it. Okay? If we don't define this and get our diagnosis, we can't fix this. So this is just that admitting. It's kind of like that 12-step program.
So a more accurate translation of dukkha is dissatisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually divide the Four Noble Truths into two twos. Like the first two are the ones we don't want. And then the second two are the two that we have to have to get rid of the two that we don't want.
Yep.
But dissatisfaction, particularly in the West, when we hear suffering, we project an attribute to that word that doesn't exist in what you're saying today. It's really more of a dissatisfaction, even dissatisfaction of change, dissatisfaction of pain, and so on. And I don't remember exactly how the suffering translation became predominant, but from the Sanskrit, dukkha is from the Sanskrit, it's dissatisfaction.
Yeah. Yeah. So Buddhism, it actually has gone through three or four translations, because it started in Pali, then it's gone into Sanskrit, then it's gone, and for us, it's gone into Tibetan. So this is one of the reasons why we try to be so clear with definitions, because it just changes just so slightly when you start translating things. And we don't actually study the Buddha's actual words. We're usually studying these different commentaries, right? And that's why it's so interesting to read the different commentaries, because just a slight word change changes the entire meaning of that. And so it's always interesting to kind of try to understand all of that. Yes, sir?
Pali? What's Pali?
It's an old language from India way back in the day, 2,600 years ago. Yeah.
Question was, what is Pali?
Yeah. So that's a pretty much lost language from 2,500 years ago. But that's what it was originally written in. Make sense with that. So start thinking of that kind of a little bit larger. Okay, the truth of the cause of suffering. So, six root delusions. We started talking about some of these words here. Those words there, ignorance, anger, attachment, pride, doubt, and wrong view, most of these can get folded into that right there. Now, remember I told you, Tibetan Buddhism loves lists. We have lists for everything. There's 6 of those, 8 of those, 10 of those, 12 of those, 36 of those, 84,000 of those. So we love lists. And so you start kind of finding your list that work for you. So it's a memory. It's a way. I told you, Geshe-la, both of the Geshe's actually have these Rolodexes in their head because one thing will spring to another. So it's kind of a memory helper, okay? But most of these can be folded right into there. Anger, hate is part of anger. Hate can also be part of fear, but fear is also part of anger. Impatience is definitely part of anger. Okay, remember I told you? I never thought of myself as an angry person. I'm not. I'm one of the easiest going people I know. I can be an impatient person, though. So specifically, some of the things that I do to work with my mind, because I never thought of myself. I actually ignored that whole column for years. I'm not angry. I don't need to read about that. I'll work on these other ones. I'm definitely ignorant. I can work on some of these other ones. But then I learned that anger, impatience is the first rung on the step of anger. Okay? Anger very rarely just blows right there, especially when you study Buddhism, because we talked about those mind moments. Anger ramps. And if you can learn to look at your mind and catch it, you can stop escalating that ramp. So I started working with impatience years ago when I realized that I am an impatient person. Lines, red lights, oh my goodness, I've got meetings to go to, I'm in a hurry, and you always, it's that Murphy's Law. When you're in a hurry, there's that flipping red light. And so I would get angry at the red light. I'd be angry. I've got negative mind. I'm frustrated. So I'm in a negative mindset. So I start recognizing these times that I'm in negative mind, and I start to work on them. So I have little what I call triggers to work with my mind. This is in a lot of the practitioners too. Okay, so going to a red light, I started saying prayers at the red lights. I had to find something to do to stop that. The lines at the grocery stores, we all do it. We're looking at these things. Where's the shortest line? Right here. Okay, and then you get in that line, and then you're still watching the other lines. Is that really moving? It's like, because this line all of a sudden stopped. And now I'm getting angry, okay? And it's like, okay, so she's up there, and all of a sudden out come the coupon books. And I'm there forever. And I'm already looking. So then I'm angry at her for using coupons, because now she's taking up my time. Or the worst yet is you've got somebody older that starts with the visiting, and there's the clerk being nice and talking to these people, and I'm mad about this? That's negative mind. You know, so so I had to work with that. I started looking at, I'm not angry, but I'm impatient, which is part of anger. So you just start working with some of these things. What are you doing in your life during the day? Have an awareness of where your mind is. Are you in a negative mind for something? Recognize it and go, okay, why? Why? Just look at it. This is the practice. This isn't a religion. This is every day. Every minute of every day. Now, I can't go there too much, but I definitely have some triggers that help me to be aware, okay, of my day. Have you seen, we all have these iPhones now, right? The mindfulness bells. Are any of you using any of those? So I've got a lot of friends who use mindfulness bells. They're little things that, you know, go off at whatever time you set, every hour, every half an hour, every 2 hours, whatever, that it dings, and you're supposed to stop and kind of pay attention. So I just started using things like red lights. Okay, ambulance. We hear them all the time. And so I started using that as a trigger. Somebody at the other end of that ambulance is in pain. Okay, so I have compassion, and I say a little prayer when I hear. So I'm trying to do positive things, and I try to use things that are positive. For a while, I was using the phone, because in my business, I get a lot of phone calls, and it is one of those things where, you know, now you got caller ID. That's even worse. You know, it's like, so I've had to work with that. So either I answer it or I stop and I think, okay, how can I approach this a little bit better? Just the tone of my voice makes the conversation better. Instead of going, you know, hello, you know, it's like, hi. Just the tone makes it a better conversation, because then they speak nicer to me. I can't control them. I can control me. So find those little triggers that you can do that are going to help. These are just some of those little things that you can do. What time is it? Oh, my goodness. Way too much talking. So ignorance, anger, attachment, pride. We're going to go through these in much more detail, but we're running out of time. Pride, we've already talked about. Okay? Pride is not good, thinking you are above somebody else. Okay, you're above, your teachings are better, or you've learned all this stuff and now you're smarter than somebody else. Pride is definitely wrong. Attachment, I'm going to save for next time because that's a longer conversation. Doubt, sometimes we question ourselves, I think, a little bit too much. Having a little bit more confidence, you know, trust in yourself a little bit more. Find your teachings, find your things that work for you, and then go for it. Wrong view is believing that it's that mistaken or deluded understanding that leads to suffering. That's a good way to put this. It's mistaking or diluting the teachings, twisting them. Okay? A lot of us can have, I think, a little bit of a willful ignorance too. And that would also be, I think, a little bit wrong view because we know better. When you know better and you still kind of go there.
So it's also the wrong view in how you think things exist.
Yes.
I mean, that's, so when they say wrong view, they're talking about the wisdom of emptiness.
Yeah. And that we're going to save. That's the last class, the wisdom of emptiness. What he's talking about.
I'm going to have to correct you on that one. Ignorance, I think, anytime you see in Buddhism is always meaning not understanding emptiness.
Ignorance is part of it. I think they all.
Wrong view is like, I took it to mean, not that, well, it's like when you pick and choose certain things that are said in the teachings for your own.
Creating your own agenda over some things.
Twist them around so that they're just wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. So we're talking about the wisdom of emptiness. We're going to talk about that. That's the last class because that is the deep end of the pool. Okay, and it's the fact that we exist in this world and we really don't see things the way that they really are. And again, we're not going to talk about this now, but that's kind of this big concept that's the biggest one in Buddhism that we're going to talk about is that we really don't see things as they truly exist. And we're going to touch on that on the last class. We are literally out of time. I talked way too much. Got off track. So I'm sorry. We'll just talk faster next time. So we've got about 5 minutes left. Let's do one more quick meditation. I'm going to do the counting the breaths again, only I will do it for another 3 minutes because not all of you raised your hand about wanting to go longer or not, and we only have a short period of time. This time, I am not going to go through the 7-point meditation posture. I've done it 3 times now. Okay, so you guys get yourself into that 7-point meditation posture the best that you can. And again, we calm our mind and we set a motivation. We always do the motivations, dedications, motivations at the beginning. And we have that Mahayana teaching, that Mahayana motivation of, I'm not just doing this for me, I'm doing this for the benefit of all sentient beings. It is a lofty goal, but just kind of work with that a little bit because it's actually very true because it's the ripple effect. If you do better, then your family will see it, your friends will see it, and it will just ripple out. So it is a very lofty goal, but it is a very real goal that you're doing this not for your own benefit, or just your own benefit, but you're taking the time now to meditate, develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to be a benefit to all beings. Okay, again, start by focusing your attention at the opening of the nostrils and pay attention to the subtle sensations as you breathe in and out through your nose. You can feel certain sensations as the air passes and as the hairs move, cooler sensations as you inhale, warmer as you exhale. Don't follow the air into your body or out into the surrounding environment, but just place your attention on the sensations associated with the breath at the opening of your nostrils. And your job is to keep your attention firmly placed on those sensations. As you inhale and exhale, mentally start counting each inhalation and exhalation together as one. Count from 1 to 10. Concentrating on those sensations. And breathe naturally. Just breathe easily and naturally. When you reach 10, begin again at 1. If you become distracted, if your mind wanders, then begin again at one. Start over. Even if you never get past two or three, it's not a problem. The point is to train your mind to focus on one point only. And I'm going to give you 3 minutes. Bring your attention back to the room, and we'll dedicate this positive energy and insights to the well-being and happiness of all living beings. I only missed 5 slides tonight. We'll catch it. 8:30. Like I said, I try to start and end on time. Any questions about anything? So next time we're going to get into karma. We're going to start talking about some of the deeper concepts, okay? We're done with kind of that historical stuff. We're all on the same page with some of the stuff. We've got a good basis with the start of understanding the Four Noble Truths and what we're talking about. And we're going to start to bring karma into all of this so you can start to get an idea of what that actually means. And again, that... our Discovering Buddhism classes allow much more deep diving. We're going to have about, 30 minutes to talk about karma when that is, something that people study their whole lives. But at least it will get you a little bit deeper understanding of it, because it's once you start working with it, it's really amazing. But we'll touch on that, and probably get it a little bit more into the mind stream and some of that continuity of the mind next time, okay? So thank you all for coming. I really appreciate your time. Thanks, you college students. There's lots of information on the website that will help you with your papers. And so y'all have a very good night. Take care. Thank you for coming.